The Farming Programme with Araquip Steel Stockholders, Withambrook Industrial Estate Grantham, supplying the region for over 40 years.
The Blue Tongue Restricted Zone has been extended to a further 7 counties, now including the whole of Lincolnshire.
Because the midges can be anywhere, if an infected animal is moved out into an uninfected zone, then it could start spreading the disease further.
We'll take a look at what's in CLA Director Kath Crowther's in tray on her return from maternity leave, and there's more on elephant grass. Miscanthus will talk to some growers about this alternative crop.
We needed a different crop. We weren't making a lot of money. What else do we do with our land? It was as simple as that.
We'll see how the markets are doing and what the weather's going to do. And Sean Sparling's here with a crop report and some timely agronomy advice.
The Week in Agriculture. This is the Farming Programme with Steve Orchard.
Hello, yes, I'm Steve Orchard, suitably refreshed after a couple of weeks away. Many thanks to Andy Marsh for looking after things. This is the Farming Programme podcast for Sunday, 29th of September, 2024. The Blue Tongue Restricted Zone has been extended further to include East Yorkshire, Kent, Sussex, Cambridgeshire, Bedfordshire, Hertfordshire, Greater London, Surrey and the whole of Lincolnshire. But vaccines are now available. The Farming Programme's Charlotte Lineker visited Lindsay Hutton, dairy farmer and the NFU's Livestock Board Member for the East Midlands, about the reasons for these restrictions and first asked her, what is Blue Tongue?
So Blue Tongue is a notifiable disease that is in cattle, livestock and sheep. It can be in llamas and alpacas, camelids, and it is spread by midges, not spread by animal to animal. When I say notifiable, that means that if we find traces of it within the animals, we have to notify Animal, Plant and Health Agency, who will come out and check for it. And we're looking at how that spreads across the country currently.
And what's the risk with that when it comes to the livestock?
The risk is higher in sheep, so we're looking at possible mortality, but the severity of it is that they can get breathing problems, lameness, crusty lesions around the nose, mouth, eyes. The tongue can actually, because of the strain of the disease, it can actually turn blue, which is where the Blue Tongue name comes from.
What's the risk for you guys as well?
Human risk is that there isn't a risk there, but the risk is loss of income. Currently, unless for some reason they have to slaughter, that if we did lose an animal, there'd be no compensation and we would have to pay for the removal of that animal from the farm. Of course, all that comes at a time when we've had problems with flooding across the county and also problems with harvest and difficulty of drilling earlier this year. So money side of things is quite a difficult issue with a lot of farmers across the region.
I imagine it just feels like it's one more thing on top of it all, really, doesn't it?
Yes, it does, yeah. And this has actually come across from the Netherlands. It did come into the country about September, October last year, but there was not as many farms and people affected as this year. It's come across again in early August. The region has spread, well, quite rapidly in the last 2-3 weeks.
Obviously, we've seen that the restriction zone now covers the whole of Lincolnshire. What's that restriction zone in aid of? What's it there for?
The restriction zone is therefore to reduce the amount of movements so that the chance of an infected animal moving out of the region is reduced, and therefore, obviously, because the midges can be anywhere, if an infected animal is moved out into an uninfected zone, then it could start spreading the disease further. If people do get particularly on the edge of the high-risk area, if you do get approached by APHA for them to come and take blood samples on your farm, I have had it done. They were here last Sunday to take blood samples. They take blood samples from 35 of the cows that are over 6 months of age, if there are more than 35 cows on the farm. It does cause a bit of stress, obviously, for the people managing the cattle and for the cattle actually going through the procedure. But on the whole, for my cattle, they seem to react quite well to it. It's come back that we have a negative for Blue Tongue at this present time.
just a really difficult challenge for you on top of everything else. Is there anything anyone can do to prevent this from happening?
The government have approved 3 vaccines. The vaccines are not preventative. They can reduce mortality and reduce severity. You have to have a prescription from your vet and be in a high-risk area to actually access the vaccine. The vaccine for sheep, I believe, is coming out at about £3 to £5 per animal, and in cattle they thought it would be somewhere between £10 and £12. So again, that's another put on the finances for these farmers.
Is that affordable for farmers across the county?
Well, for us, I mean, because I've got 106 on farm, you're looking that would be about £1,000 if we went ahead and did it. Because it's not preventative, they could still get it, but it's obviously going to reduce the symptoms. At the moment, for most farms, it only tends to be affecting 2 to 3 animals on each farm. So at the moment, we're not looking to get the vaccine for that reason.
Thank you, Lindsay. If you have any concerns or you're not sure whether it's on your farm, speak to your vet or call APHA on 03000 233 301. Last week, Lincolnshire arable farmer Colin Chappell opened his farm near Hibblestow, along with Tara Vesta and Waldmarsh, to a group of us to talk about and look at his crop of miscanthus. He and several others have been growing so-called elephant grass for many years as an alternative crop, as has Andrew Lyle from Claxby. Colin, first, when did you start with miscanthus and why?
2006, 2007, we started growing it. Those were the days when the grain prices were £60-70 a tonne. We still had set aside in those days, believe it or not. It was that long ago. And it was just a financial decision of we needed a different crop. We weren't making a lot of money. What else do we do with our land? It was as simple as that.
So an alternative to cereal crops?
I do like alternatives. I do like growing something different. It's a bit of a change from the same old, and it just piqued my interest.
What about you, Andrew? Why did you get into it?
Really just taking land out of production, which was a bit heavy, and it didn't really produce very good crops, and we had a chance of producing a fairly good seed bed and getting it established and rolled in, and it's still producing now.
Is it then a good crop for those difficult fields, for the poor soil, do you think?
Yes, for me, I relate everything to winter wheat. So I couldn't get good yields of winter wheat from these 4 fields which I originally planted, and it was just a case of they're awkward, they're funny shaped, they're different soil types. We weren't getting any returns from conventional cropping, in inverted commas, and therefore it just was a natural fit for me.
Now this is a long-term crop, isn't it? You plant it and it's got a typical lifespan of what?
20, 25 years. There are crops out there doing 30, 35 years. It is once planted, forget about it almost. Just keep harvesting it year in, year out.
So what happens to it then? What's the market for it?
Well, we just, at the time, when we first started it, we sent it off to Drax Power Station. Now, Brigg actually take it straight off farm, straight into there and burn it within, I think my crop lasted about 2 days in Brigg. Job done.
So they're saying they handle something like 30,000 tonnes a year at Brigg?
Yeah, I have, 500 tonnes, I think, and it's gone in 2 days.
So in terms of the crop itself, it goes in, it stays in for 20 years. Have you not got to do anything with it? What about inputs? What about preparation for harvest and so on?
Yeah, very, very low input. The initial maybe first, second year, you might need to do a herbicide for broadleaf weeds, but it's sort of one of those ones you plant and forget about. It doesn't need chemistry of any sort. You don't need a fungicide, you don't need insecticide. In fact, they tick some boxes for the SFI scheme. All your input really is to move the bales off the field. That is really all your input. It tends to be a contractor floors it and a contractor bales it. All we do is move the bales.
So you plant when and you harvest when?
I think we planted ours in about May-ish, May, June, or probably April, May. You get your seed bed to about sort of 8 inches of tilth. Get it in and then roll it down as hard as you can to get the moisture in. You don't get a harvest for 2 years. Third year, you probably get a harvest, cut it and bale it, and that's usually end of March, beginning of April.
So you've got a bit of a sort of initial investment in this. You're not going to see any return from it for a couple of years.
No, no, you're not going to get a return for a couple of years, but long term, you will do, yeah.
Okay, and from a harvesting point of view, you've got your contractor coming in. How difficult is harvesting?
It's a doddle, really, because you're not involved. You don't have breakdowns. You know, it's all on the contractor's shoulders. You don't have the breakdowns. You don't have the hassle. All your say would probably be was whether if you thought it was too wet to harvest it, or there was some reason why you couldn't access the field. But, you know, it is a very low-risk crop. You don't really have to think about it. You sort of plant it and forget about it. And that's the beauty behind it.
Is it a difficult crop to harvest, though?
No, I wouldn't say so. It does have quite a hard lifespan on tyres. It's quite abrasive, but no, I wouldn't say it's very difficult at all. It just requires a different way of thinking about cropping.
Okay. And going back a step, really, are there any problems that you would have in establishment or pre-establishment?
I'd say no, really. If we're talking about, the only thing you've got a problem with is rabbits, but because this new variety is so quick, I had a field which is right next to the railway line, and I was a bit concerned about rabbits, so I put electric fencing up and we kept them out. And to be honest, the way the miscanthus grew was that quick, the rabbits didn't have a chance to eat it off. It just grew.
The only potential problem is if you're coming out of a grass rotation and then you try and plant in that year to plant miscanthus, you will get a wireworm issue. But literally, that is virtually the only problem I can think of with miscanthus.
Now, Andrew, you talked about a new variety because you've gone from Gigantus. There is a new variety now available.
Yeah, Anthem. It's Athena. Yeah, it performs well.
Is it worth changing, or is it just a sort of a development of the old crop?
Personally, Andrew's maybe thinking slightly differently to me. Athena is a hybrid crop. Hybrid crops, as we grow all these other crops, we grow hybrid oilseed rape on this farm, we grow hybrid rye and hybrid winter barley. They are more resilient. They are a combination of other crops. They're not just conventional sort of lacklustre crops. Hybrid has more vigour, has more pushes disease away. It just is a better crop, full stop.
Now, from an economic point of view, you're getting a yield which is fantastic compared to cereal crops, 12, 13, 14 tonnes a hectare. But in terms of what you actually get for that crop, obviously it's got to be economic for you. Is it worthwhile?
Yeah, the big thing is the initial investment to plant the crop. It is an expensive crop to establish. And the trouble with farming is, you sort of want to plant it and want to harvest within 9 months. And it's a yearly cycle, and farmers get hung up on that. BPS is disappearing, SFI is appearing. We have to think differently, we have to farm differently, probably for a very large investment, but over the course of 25 years, it is actually cost effective after the fourth or fifth year. You know, it looks after itself. It just requires the farmer to think slightly differently about the future.
You say a fairly substantial initial investment. What sort of money are we talking about?
I knew you were going to ask me that question. He's grinning now. We are probably talking £2,000 a hectare to establish the crop.
And you're breaking even year three, four?
Year four or five. So therefore, your initial investment takes 5 years to bring back that money you've invested on it. But from year five to year 25 is profit.
And is there better land for this? Crops can vary enormously depending on the land. Is there a better or worse land for miscanthus?
Personally, well, we'll ask Andrew in a second, but I grow on sand and on clay, and it's just like every other crop. Some years, like the year we've just been through, is better on sand. Some years, when it's drier, he smiles, it can alter. Andrew's on lighter soil type.
I think if your wheat grows on the land, miscanthus will grow on the land. If it's that heavy, I have reservations for miscanthus. Okay, but if it won't grow wheat, it has a job to grow miscanthus.
And I guess it's less volatile than a conventional crop in terms of the yield and the money.
Yield is more consistent. your monetary return, it's retail price index linked, so you, the actual amount you're going to get paid goes up every year. Your yield will vary from year to year. As a rule, you'll get more return every year.
And that's on a contract with Terra Vesta, so you know what you're going to get.
Yeah, and it's a guaranteed return. You don't really have to worry about it. It's a stress-free crop. You don't have to think about, you know, it falling over in snow, wind, hail, flooding. It will survive the lot.
Okay. Final question to you both. You've grown this for quite some time. Would you grow more?
No. The only comment I would say is don't put it outside your front living room window, because you lose your land basically. It has to be selected in the right place. I would say don't put it too close to your house. Don't put. It's good for the wildlife. And the other benefit I have from it, because I do a lot of school visits, I do about 17, 20 school visits a year. The kids love it. I don't get them in it because it's a little bit of a, it's very sharp and you lose kids. I don't want to lose children on the school visits, but they get quite enthusiastic about, oh, you're growing that to produce electricity and that produce. And then it starts another conversation other than growing wheat for Warburtons or whatever, or barley for beer. So, yeah.
And what about you, Colin? You've grown it for quite some time. Would you grow more? Would you grow again with it?
Yeah, so I'm slightly different. I have planted an extra field. I'm in the Ancone, you are now in the Ancone Valley. We've suffered severe flooding for the last 5 years. I'm running out of options for conventional cropping on this farm. Do I embrace biodiversity net gain? Do I look at expanding Miscanthus? Unfortunately, the decision might be beyond me, because for me, 25 years is Jack, the next generation. I think it is viable. Jack's decision, because he's looking after the farm for the next 25 years.
All right, chaps. Thank you both very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
If you want to know more, I'm sure Colin will be happy to chat, or contact Terra Vesta at terravesta.com. To the more conventional crops now, with some timely agronomy advice for us, a soggy Sean Sparling again. Morning, Sean.
Yes, morning, Steve. I know, another wet week to finish off September. 84.5 mm rain for me in September. Drip and a drop forecast to start October as well too. So no immediate change there. But with that switch from the proper wet and windy stuff in the first half of the week to the hopefully correct warmer forecast towards the end of this coming week, hopes start to rise that if it stays like this for a couple more weeks, you know, September's wet stuff could just have set us up for a cracking autumn drilling campaign. It'd be nice to get back to one of those Octobers we used to have, wouldn't it, where we had a few damp days throughout the month and the rain was all spread out. Drilling has always, of course, been a challenge in what is the main drilling month of October, as things cool down and it doesn't dry out as quickly as it does in September. But it's rarely been unachievable to get the drilling done in October's weather over the years. I know we've had a couple of exceptions to that in the last 35, 36 years, but there's always a bit that's going to get mauled in. But we do have the tools and the technology to deal with the old type of October. I really miss the old Octobers of my youth, because the trouble is now, of course, there does seem to be a seemingly new normal October, where we either break all the rainfall records for the month in about an hour on the second day, and then it takes the rest of the month to dry out enough to get drilling, and the day it is dry enough to go drilling is the day when the next record breaking lot of rain comes, just to jigger us up all over again. Remember last autumn? Either that, or it turns cold and damp and it goes perpetually sticky in the field and doesn't dry out, meaning we can't physically drill even if we want to. But just take solace in the fact that we're having to wait for that good old blackgrass flush anyway in the blackgrassy field. But the weather in October has always been a potential problem to us, and it always will be a problem to us. But it's the severity and the frequency of the dodgy October weather that makes or breaks our drilling season. The trouble is, we won't know any of that until we get there and we look back. And that's why I know that when it's fit to go drilling, we're all going to be off, blackgrass land or not. And there's nothing we can do about the weather. So planning, therefore, is key. Calendar date, completely irrelevant when it comes to blackgrass. It's the seed dormancy and whether it's already flushed in the seedbed before you set off drilling. We're almost in October now, the swallows have gone, so I suppose it's not too early to drill. However, if you're on blackgrass land, taking out a big old flush before you drill is obviously your priority, and then getting a half decent seedbed in order to make sure that the pre-ems get a fighting chance of doing some good. That's the key. It's simple, really. And with that wet 2023 autumn washing the herbicides through or preventing pre-ems actually going on to drill crops altogether and the resulting levels of blackgrass we saw last season, that means that you've got more blackgrass from the seed return to start with than you may care to admit on many of these fields. And remember, it's the flash of UV light from the cultivation which is going to trigger another flush of blackgrass to germinate. So if the drill is the first cultivation through that seedbed, getting your pre-em on within 24, 48 hours of that pass is going to be incredibly important. We've got very effective pre-ems, synmethylene, flufenacet, aclonifen, but they're not magic. They need all the help that they can get. And stale seed beds are a crucial part of that. You know that and I know that. The weather is helping to ensure that these seed beds, the stale seed beds, get an opportunity to do their job. We've got moderate to high dormancy of blackgrass in the seed this year, which is the opposite of last year. And because of that, it's really only just starting to come through on even the kind of land. There's very little to see at all yet in the heavier fields, but there are an awful lot of growers out there itching to get drilling on this blackgrass land. Clearly plenty of those have already started scratching their itch, so trust your gut, trust your advisor, play the percentages, and may God be with you. And if he's not, then abandon hope, all you who enter here. When you do get drilling, remember to drill the seed at least 40 millimetres deep and get it well covered. 40 mil after it's been rolled, if you get the opportunity to roll. And it needs to be covered in order to protect it from the likes of trialate, synmethylene, flufenacet, prosulfocarb, pendimethylene, aclonifen, DFF, a little bit less mobile in the profile. They tend to stay nearer the surface or on it. But if you get the seed bed wrong, the drilling depth too shallow or a crop showing through, it's not covered, or you get a deluge of heavy rain immediately after you've applied that pre-em, you're going to be looking at proper crop damage and fields as gold as a guinea till April if you're not careful, because it's selectivity by depth protection. Just make sure the seeds are at a safe depth, minimum of 32, preferably 40 mil. So it's important to watch the prevailing weather and the conditions following application as well. Aclonifen and flufenacet uptake in particular can be very dramatic when they get washed down to the seed. You know, there's always potential this time of year for a sharp shower to do that, and I know that quite often the visible bleaching effects of things like DFF will be transient and crops are going to grow out of it, but it can be much more long-lasting damage from direct contact onto exposed seeds from some herbicide, in fact all of the above. So do speak to your advisor and just make sure you're paying attention to these seed beds. Slugs popping up everywhere as well now thanks to these wet conditions, so be alert to them, particularly after oilseed rape and peas, or where you've had history of slugs and where you've got uneven seedbed. Wet process pellets probably your best option. They're going to stand a little bit more weather on them. So when you do get drilling, you're aiming to establish around 200-225 plants per square metre at this time of year, with the target seed rate going up by 25 plants every 7 days or so. And do your calculations based on the 1,000 grain weight, the germination and the potential field losses. And never underestimate the impact of soil type, final seedbed conditions, weed burden, particularly blackgrass and ryegrass, slug risk as well. And the risk of slugs is very high at the moment. So do your own sums. Whatever seed rate your neighbour's drilling at, it's totally irrelevant to you and yours. So do your own homework. Sugar beet fungicide, by the way, if you've still got any of those to go on, they want to be on if you're going to get your money back. As these things turn colder, efficacy and usefulness is going to drop off. The diseases are all pretty slow at the moment, and their threat is going to decrease too as conditions cool down over the coming 2 or 3 weeks. So prioritise your backward crops with the smaller canopies and where they're going to be late lifted. Right, here we go then. Let's see what the next 7 days bring.
Thanks, Sean. Back same time next week. And back from maternity leave number 2 is CLA Director Kath Crowther. We'll see what's in her in tray and take a look at the livestock and grain markets next.
The Farming Programme with Arrowquip Steel Stockholders, Withambrook Industrial Estate Grantham. For all your steel needs, call their friendly experts.
This is the Farming Programme podcast for Sunday the 29th of September 2024. I'm Steve Orchard, and it's nice to be back after a couple of weeks holiday, and good to welcome back after a slightly longer absence following maternity number 2, CLA Director Kath Crowther. So how's the enlarged family?
Yes, very well, thank you. Growing quickly and time has flown, but great to be back and to be representing members again.
And you never really switch off, I guess, do you, with a job like yours?
Well, I'm a farmer's daughter, passionate about the industry, and it genuinely interests me. So I have been keeping in touch and seeing quite a few members and keeping in touch with the team and policy-wise as well, just knowing what's going on in the background.
So what was sat waiting for you in your in-tray when you got back?
So day two at the moment, but SFI, ELMS, farming budget, absolutely is key. Tax and making sure that there's a recognition of why APR, agricultural property relief, and business property relief are absolutely essential to the future of family farms. Planning, you know, we've spoken over and over again, Steve, over the years about planning and connectivity, holding back the rural economy. And that's something that we really, really need to concentrate on and try and see an improvement, because as a benefit to the wider economy, rural businesses could be delivering so much more in terms of returns and housing numbers. You know, we've been pushing for a small number of houses in a large number of villages for many, many years. That could help towards these key housing targets. Let's see that incremental growth that supports local services, a few houses on the edge of each village, rather than just massive towns which take up huge infrastructure. Flooding, obviously, water is a key issue. And this week, you know, the amount of water that we've seen this week, access, rural crime, there's a lot going on. And I guess that one of our key priorities at the moment is making sure that we're fostering those relationships with new MPs, new ministers, and so they recognise the importance of rural businesses. And I just encourage all of your listeners to ensure that they're in contact with us if they are meeting with MPs or if they would like to host visits. We're really, really keen to demonstrate the importance of rural businesses and what they could deliver for the wider economy.
I think last time I saw you was at Cereals and the Lincolnshire Show. And, you know, as I review the years that you've been away, you've not really missed much. We've had a bit of weather, we had a bit of politics, you know, pretty much a normal year, really, haven't we?
Yeah, there's some interesting times. And I guess that the key issues for our members are very similar, but it's making sure that we're concentrating on the right things at the right time. And with a new government, then, you know, that's the key priority at the moment.
And I gather you've got a document that you've published to try and help this political situation along.
Yeah, so a few days after the election, we sent out a programme for government delivering Labour's manifesto for the rural economy document. And that's designed to look at the Labour government's manifesto and make sure that current government understands how rural businesses can help them deliver what they wanted to deliver. And in turn, that helps all of our members and the rural businesses.
Because the Labour government, or a Labour government, is generally not seen as being that friendly towards the landowning classes, shall we put it politely. I'm assuming, given the situation and the huge overwhelming majority that they won, we've got to work together.
Absolutely. And it provides an opportunity because we've been meeting with lots of MPs who haven't got a history of understanding rural businesses, but they're listening. And so that's key, is to make sure that we're talking to them, they understand the importance, and that they're getting briefings from us on the relevant topics, and they understand why it's important. Or, for instance, the unintended consequences of a policy that's being put forward. For instance, energy performance certificates C by 2030 of rural housing. At the moment, that's just absolutely not achievable. So putting a blanket policy which has good intentions of decarbonising housing stock, great. But we could just see mass exodus of rural properties and they would be sold to second homeowners, people moving out of towns and cities rather than going to local people. So it's explaining the intricacies of the policies and making sure they're talking to us about it.
I think the concerns that seem to be expressed to me whenever I meet farmers is, where are we going? We don't seem to know really what's happening Again, we don't seem to be getting an awful lot of detail as to what the government's priorities are. All we hear about are budget cuts at the moment.
Yeah, and we're working really hard to try and make sure that the agriculture budget is there. As a industry, we are delivering a huge amount for wider public, environmental targets, etc. But that can't be done without a budget put behind it. And so we have put forward the arguments for why there needs to be a ring-fenced budget for agriculture and on all of those other things. So the agriculture budget is key, and you know, food security, but it's also the wider rural economy and the importance of that recognised. And I guess with a Labour government who aren't traditionally seen as understanding rural issues, it's making sure that they are aware of all of the work that our members do. You know, they include agriculture, which is key, absolutely, tourism, hospitality, retail, commercial, residential lettings. CLA members provide a huge amount of housing, but we're also being impacted by a lot of the new policies, for instance, infrastructure projects coming through, and making sure that it's fair there. So you're right, the budget is really important, and we've just put our spending review submission in ahead of the budget to make sure that all of the different aspects are considered, for instance, that planning departments are properly resourced, because they are holding back agriculture and they're holding back diversified businesses as well.
Now, just about a year ago, it started raining and it didn't really stop for quite some considerable time. And we've still got parcels of land within this area and across the wider country with some problems relating to flooding. And unless we get some action taken and some work done, that's just going to happen again, isn't it?
Completely agree. So there's two aspects of that. There's the importance of maintenance of existing rivers and infrastructure, because over the last few years, the EA, when they've been given budget, it's all been focused on new capital projects. But the return on investment for maintenance is so much higher. And there's very, very little maintenance going on, which has such a big knock-on impact. So we must see maintenance of existing infrastructure. And we also must see it recognised that our members, that landowners, farmers, are often saving houses and businesses. And I think that we would always recognise that farmland is likely to be flooded over homes and businesses, but it's not fair that that water is being stored and not being compensated for. So it's making sure that there's fairness there as well.
But this kind of comes back to the politics and the budget again, though, doesn't it?
Yeah, and we know that there's not much money there, and there's going to be lots of priorities that may be seen to be more important. So we've got to be there fighting that argument, making the justifications and demonstrating why it's so, so important that the money goes into all of these different parts that we're asking for.
And SFI continues its developments. It sort of paused for a while. It's back open again now, and we're still transitioning, aren't we?
Yeah, and we still agree that it is the right direction to go. And the principles behind it are absolutely right. We definitely need to continue on this trajectory, because we could see the budget disappearing from our industry completely if we don't see uptake. We just need to make sure that it's refined and it works for farmers, so that we do need to see some simplification, but we also need it to be properly resource, so we need the budget allocated to it, because otherwise obviously we're not going to see that uptake.
There is a danger though, isn't there, with some of the SFI schemes, that it ends up just taking land out of food production.
And you know, there is that, there's been that worry there. I think that there was obviously a lot of changes this year off the back of concerns around food security, We want there to be choice. What we need is a SFI system that works properly for the right thing in the right place, and for food security to be looked at, and, you know, supply chain fairness, etc., also to be considered. So it's got to be looked at in the round.
All right, Kath, good to have you back. There's our CLA Regional Director, Kath Crowther. Thank you for joining us once again on the Farming Programme. Welcome back.
Thanks, Steve.
The Farming Programme.
Market reports.
Starting as usual with livestock from Masons Rural at Louth Market, auctioneer Edward Middleton. Good morning.
Good morning, Steve. This week we start with the prime cattle as usual, with the prime steers all in average at 283.5 pence per kilo, and the prime heifers all in average 283.28 pence per kilo. Top price in the steers, in the pounds per head and the pence per kilo, went to J.E. Thilby of Kexby at 283.5 pence per kilo, or £1,786.05. In the heifers, J.N.S. Brooks topped the pence per kilo at 299.5 pence per kilo, and J.E. Thilby from Kexby in the pounds per head at £1,811.18. There's a handful of cool cows this week, topping at 173.5 pence per kilo, or £1,353.30 for Stuart Renshaw of Tetford. Just a reminder, we've got our autumn suckle calf and store cattle sale coming up on Friday the 4th of October. Moving on to the sheep, this week we had an absolutely cracking trade right the way through. Lambs, well past the 300 pence mark. We had a SQQ of 306.13 pence per kilo and an all-in average of £133.68. Top spot went to J.A. and C.J. Jackson of Osgoby with a super pen of 50.5 kilo Charolais cross lambs at £157, with other pens at £154 and £153. Ben and Pippa Williams of Mablethorpe topped the pence per kilo at 338 pence per kilo, with other pens at 329 and 316. That concludes this week's market report. A reminder, we've taken entries for both our store cattle sales on Friday the 4th and Friday the 18th. Back to business as usual on Monday. Prime cattle and all classes of sheep, lambs especially, required. Look forward to receiving your entries for Monday. I'm Edward Middleton, auctioneer at Louth Livestock Market.
Thanks, Edward, and to the grain markets with Open Fields' Alice Killam. Morning, Alice.
Good morning, Steve. In truth, we've seen a quiet couple of days. It feels to me that we're in this holding pattern, waiting for something to happen. Normally, this would equal a drifting market where values just fade, but I think there are enough reasons to be a little more positive than that. We are followers of the market here, we know that, so global events are the only thing that will shift the needle. This is certainly not guaranteed, but with some potential supply issues and an escalating situation in both Ukraine and the Middle East, it does make for some logic as to why the fund managers have heavily reduced their short positions. No fireworks over the last 2 days, and I'm conscious of the last move up, which was extinguished over a 12-hour period. But we are creeping back towards the higher end of the 180 to 185 mark again on the UK NOF futures. We need to keep an eye out on weather issues. Brazil is still dry, with the forecast to receive just 24% of its normal rainfall in the next 2 weeks. The Black Sea is also experiencing something similar, with Ukraine crop getting worse and not better. It is restricting drilling and threatening that which is already growing. Couple this with the speed of exports to date and the way that many are front-loading their export programmes. I'm not suggesting that we're going to see a £50 rise in values tomorrow, but there are credible reasons for a small increase in values if some of these issues play out. Back to the UK then. This week we've seen some further DEFRA numbers released concerning our own ending stocks, effectively what we carry over into the new season. Of course, this is no way going to make up for this year's shortfall. It is why we are IMMA, so this is a positive if you need to keep things moving along. And with a physical carry in the market, which mirrors the future spread, there are some reasonable carries also for those who are looking to make spring and summer 25 sales. Amongst the gloom, there are some opportunities which are a little better than what we have received to date. Whilst we wait for some bigger stories to arrive, I'm afraid this is where we're at. Keep chipping away on good days and don't miss the opportunities when they come. Not a great deal different from last week. In the meantime, let's hope for some drier weather over the coming days so we can start concentrating on the drilling of next season's crop. We are all very nervous for obvious reasons after the experience of 12 months ago. As I was told a couple of days ago, it's not October yet. I take his point, though I think he is trying to make us both feel better. Guide values for this week, circa Friday morning. Feed wheat, October 180 to 190, January 185 to 195, May 190 to 200, with Group 1 milling premiums at £50 to £60. Feed barley, October 150 to 160, February 155 to 165, May 160 to 170, and all seed rape, October 390 to 395, and May 400 to 405. As usual, please call for firm values.
Thanks, Alice.
The Farming Programme. 5-day forecast.
Some heavy rain around Monday and Tuesday. After that, it's looking to be a drier week. Light and variable breezes, patchy sunshine, and daytime highs in the mid-teens Celsius, overnight staying in double figures. Cereal planting, straw, and a big event for your diary. The Week in Agriculture returns next Sunday from 7, or whenever you want on the new Rayo app. Enjoy National Carrot Day on Thursday. Oh, and congratulations to TFA Chief Exec George Dunn, who's been awarded an honorary doctorate by Harper Adams University in recognition of his huge contribution to supporting tenant farmers and his charity work with the wider industry. Well deserved. Congratulations, George. I'm Steve Orchard. Until next time, have a great week.
The Farming Programme with Araquip Steel Stockholders, Withambrook Industrial Estate Grantham, BSI ISO 9001 accredited.